Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now we continue our series, The Eights, a brief history of the American culture wars, decade by decade. This week we're in 1968, and today's question is, how close was Richard Nixon's brand of backlash populism to Donald Trump's? And more broadly, how the heck at the end of the counterculture 1960s did the United States elect Richard Nixon, of all people, President of the United States? Cokie Roberts and Elizabeth Drew will be on in a little while to talk about it. But let's start here. We don't want to overlook that Nixon did have opponents for the Republican nomination that year. Let's listen to two of them. Mitt Romney's father, George Romney. Many of you have never heard this man's voice, and he was significant in the United States. He was governor of Michigan. He had been president of the American Motors, you know, that made Ramblers and those cars. So he was huge in the auto industry, and then governor of Michigan, and he was a presidential hopeful. George Romney was considered a moderate compared to Nixon, but he still homed right in on culture war themes. Listen in this clip to how he explicitly defends the establishment and suggests that Black America was about to start a guerrilla war.
The size and complexity of our national problems have bred a widespread sense of personal futility. We've begun to see acceptance of irresponsibility as a way of life. There's a growing aimlessness and flabbiness in our American society. The evidence is everywhere. Too frequently, family responsibilities are preempted by government and weakened by obsolete welfare policies that cripple each new generation of the poor. The crime rate mounts, and over half the major crimes are committed by teenagers. To avoid a society that seems to offer no cause worth serving, too many turn to drugs, alcoholism, or other means of escape. Too often young people who are just bursting with idealism either find themselves playing a game for which they have little heart or are hurling themselves into wasteful protest against the so-called establishment. Men and women in the slums, bitter over unfilled promises, listen to revolutionaries who would plunge us into guerrilla civil warfare. We're becoming a house divided.
George Romney, father of Mitt, running for president in 1968. I guess old George started the frat bro naming thing. His name was just George, but he named a second son Mitt, like a baseball glove. Mitt named his first son Tag, which of course is something you can do with a mitt. Also running against Nixon was Ronald Reagan, then the governor of California and already a diehard conservative ideologue. Reagan, of course, would go on to be elected president in 1980, but already in 68, he was talking about freedom in anti-counterculture terms.
There are things for which, if need be, we are willing to die. And one such thing is freedom. Will we as a nation burn our draft card, or will we serve above and beyond the call of duty?
Now, opposing being drafted into a corrosive war represented the cause of freedom to many baby boomers. To Reagan, as you heard in that clip from 68, freedom was the opposite of that. And Nixon himself invoked similar pro-war language that he tied to cultural mores in his acceptance speech at the Republican convention as he invoked his slogan, the silent majority. Here's 30 seconds of that.
Did we come all this way for this? Did American boys die in Normandy and Korea and in Valley Forge for this? Listen to the answer to those questions. It is another voice. It is a quiet voice in the tumult of the shouting. It is the voice of the great majority of Americans, the forgotten Americans, the non-shouters, the non-demonstrators. They're not racist or sick. They're not guilty of the crime that plagues the land.
Richard Nixon from his Republican convention acceptance speech. Now, one New York City footnote to that Miami Beach convention, Mayor John Lindsay, New York's Republican mayor at that time, was being floated as a moderate alternative to the hard right Spiro Agnew to be Nixon's running mate and do this sort of conservative Republican, liberal Republican unity ticket. But Lindsay declined to make himself an issue and instead seconded Agnew's nomination on the floor, Unity for the Right of the Party. Yesterday's guest in this series, Lawrence O'Donnell, who wrote a book on the 68 election, said Donald Trump actually modeled himself less on Nixon than on the third party candidate in 1968, the segregationist governor of Alabama, George Wallace, who actually won five southern states, 46 electoral votes, and 13% of the popular vote that year. So, for example, here is Wallace in 68, pugnaciously telling protesters to go away.
Why don't you young punks get out of the auditorium?
Well, young punks get out of the auditorium. And Trump in 2016?
Look at these people. Boy, what a bunch of losers, I'll tell you. You are a loser. You really are a loser.
Ready? Are you ready? Get them out of here! Get them out of here! Get the hell out of here!
More George Wallace than Richard Nixon, to be sure. Here is Wallace singling out the New York Times as an enemy of the people.
The average citizen in this county has more intelligence and sense in his little finger than the editor of the New York Times has in his whole head.
And Trump in 2016.
By the way, New York Times, which is failing, really failing badly, which I call it the failing New York Times. Every story they write is a hit job.
And one more of George Wallace, 68.
But I want to tell these national parties this. They're going to find out there are a lot of rednecks come November 5th in this country. They've used us as a doormat long enough.
They'll find out there's a lot of rednecks in this country come Election Day and talking about the world. They've used us as doormats, and of what he considered real Americans, used us as doormats for others' concerns. Sound familiar?
The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems.
So it's the Eights, a brief history of the culture wars, decade by decade. We are in 1968, and we'll listen to more from the archives from 1968 as we go and talk to Cokie Roberts and Elizabeth Drew. Stay with us. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We're doing our series, The Eights, a brief history of the American culture wars, decade by decade. This week, we are in 1968, and today's question is, how close was Richard Nixon's brand of backlash populism to Donald Trump's? And more broadly, how the heck at the end of the counterculture 1960s did the U.S. elect Richard Nixon, of all people, President of the United States? With me now, an all-star duo on Nixon's backlash populism and any similarities with today, NPR senior political analyst Cokie Roberts, and Elizabeth Drew, who was a Washington correspondent for The Atlantic in 1968. These days, she's a contributor to the New York Review of Books. She also wrote a book about Richard Nixon. Good morning, Cokie. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Elizabeth. Nice to
morning,
talk to
Cokie.
Both of you.
So, Elizabeth,
how are you doing?
Elizabeth, it was so interesting for me yesterday to read your April 1968 article about the election on the Atlantic.
You notice, Elizabeth, he brings in the old ladies for this.
Yes,
particular
that's right.
We've had people with memories from 1948 on in this series, and you quoted a former Census Bureau director saying the essential fact about the 1968 electorate was that it was un-young, un-black, and unpoor. Sounds
yes.
strikingly similar to how Trump beat Clinton, but it was even more the case in 68, wasn't it?
Famous Scammon articulation of the electorate.
Right, Mr. Scammon, the former Census Bureau director. Elizabeth, what do you remember?
Well, that was supposed to be a fairly shocking approach to our politics, because we had a kind of youth-centered politics, and Scammon was saying, what he was really saying is if the Democrats go this way, they're going to lose. They're talking that there aren't that many blacks who are out there and who vote. Of course, now they systematically try to keep them from voting, so I don't know that that's an advance. And most of the voters are going to be middle class, and they're not going to be the youth. So if the Democrats are trying to appeal to those groups of people, they're not going to win. Now, as you know, as both of you know, that election was, you know, a hairbreadth close. And there's been a theory. I think one could overdo something like that. There's been a longstanding theory that had the election gone on for another week, Humphrey would have won. It was extremely close. And it had to do with whether Lyndon Johnson would stop the bombing of North Vietnam. Mm. And so, a lot of factors played into that. And the other book, and I'm sure Cokie remembers as well, was and probably more important at the time, was one by Kevin Phillips, the Emerging Republican sure. Party. And he was saying that the way for the Republicans to win was to appeal to the South, hint, whites, and blue-collar voters and blue-collar workers. And he kind of had it right. I would say that is more the prototype for our current Republican politics than Scammon's book was.
The emerging Republican majority by Kevin Phillips back then, and some people will remember that Kevin and Cokie used to do the weekly Monday morning political analysis.
Sometimes accompanied by my Basset Hound Abner. Elizabeth, of course, is right. There was so much going on in that election. But you can't leave out George Wallace in that analysis, because if you combine the Nixon vote and the Wallace vote, you get a very middle-class white vote. And, you know, Wallace is the last third-party candidate to get any electoral college votes. And so you really had an understanding on his part and on the part. And by the way, the campaign he waged was not a racist campaign. He didn't go out. I mean, he had some dog whistle things, but he didn't go out and rail against black people or anything like that. He sounded so much like Donald Trump on the stump that it's really kind of eerie. And
are you talking about Nixon or Wallace?
I'm talking about George Wallace.
Yeah.
And a very populist approach. And, you know, instead of draining the swamp, it was getting those pointy-headed eggheads out of Washington.
Pointy-headed bureaucrats.
Right. To understand, you know, understanding that people thought that Washington didn't pay any attention to them. And the Democrats continue to fall into that trap. Things haven't changed that much.
Now, listeners, for your oral history contribution to the eights today, how about anyone who remembers voting for Richard Nixon in 1968? Yesterday, we did McCarthy and RFK and Hubert Humphrey voters. For today, anyone listening right now willing to call up and remember voting for Nixon and why? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. And let's see if we get anyone. You know, everyone from that era claims they were at Woodstock in 1969, whether they were or not.
Well, maybe no one
from that era who voted for Nixon will admit it, but maybe you will. So listeners, we're trying to understand in this history series, The Eights, why Richard Nixon, of all people, was elected president of the United States.
Brian, can I come in on that?
You can in a second. Let me just make sure they have the question and the phone number. Listeners, help us with your own memory of voting for Nixon in 1968 in particular. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 with Cokie Roberts and Elizabeth Drew. And Elizabeth, go ahead.
Well, I think one thing is we're sort of working backwards, saying Richard Nixon of all people, and we're thinking about the Richard Nixon of 1973-74 right. when he got into the whole Watergate morass. The Nixon of 68 had been in the House of Representatives. He'd been in the Senate. He'd been vice president for 8 years. He was not an unrespectable figure. There's always been a side of Nixon that people didn't like. He was called Tricky Dick from the days he started in politics in California. But the Nixon who got elected was experienced, And Humphrey had his own weaknesses. I mean, you can't say one without counting how the other one behaved. And, of course, the problem that Humphrey had is he was completely trapped by Lyndon Johnson and Johnson's conduct of the war in Vietnam. And Humphrey begged him to cut off the bombing of the North, and he just wouldn't do it until close to the end, and it said too close to the end. So the Nixon of 68 is not the Nixon that we all remember so clearly. If those like Cokie and I are antiquities who were alive during Watergate, that's the Nixon that you're comparing it to.
I think that's a very good point, Elizabeth. The and you don't forget, Brian, the 1968 convention for the Democrats had also been part of the picture, and I remember being at that convention. And it was, it was not something that the American people liked looking at. They didn't see a party that seemed to be respectable, didn't seem to be able to manage anything, and was certainly not something that they identified with if you were a middle-class mom living in Akron, Ohio.
Don't mention the violence, Cokie.
And then there was violence on both sides.
Now, you've mentioned, and our guest yesterday, Lawrence O'Donnell, who wrote a book, Playing with Fire, about the election of 68. You've all said Trump has been modeling himself more explicitly on George Wallace than Nixon. Here are two more short examples of that from Wallace 68. Here's Wallace dissing young men in 68 who wore long hair and called for peace and love.
I love you too, I sure do. Oh, I thought you were she. You are he. Oh, my goodness.
Today, it's Trump's anti-transgender policies objecting to the crossing of he and she. And here is George Wallace in 68 threatening official violence, really, against protesters if they engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience like they did one time with President Johnson.
And when he was in California, a group of anarchists lay down in front of his automobile and threaten his personal safety, the President of the United States. Well, I want to tell you, if you'll elect me the President, and I go to California, or I come to Arkansas, and some of them lie down in front of my automobile, it'll be the last one they'll ever want to lie down in front of.
Some of them, if they lie down in front of my automobile, it'll be the last thing they ever lie down in front of them. And we know that Trump
it
has...
It sounds very familiar, but I don't... I think it's... I doubt that Donald Trump is actually modeling himself after George Wallace.
Right.
I suspect he's
just
barely
like
heard
that.
Of George Wallace. But he understands. He understands the same strain in the American electorate of a lot of people who feel like they have been left out of the political calculations and who feel that both parties are ignoring them and that that they want a champion for them who tells it like it is, as they would say.
And let me,
and I think that that's something that Donald Trump understands in a way that George Wallace also did.
And so by contrast with those Wallace clips, here's how carefully Nixon was trying to walk the line while still running this Southern strategy, as it's known, kind of racialized campaign, but sounding like he's for civil rights, but then still coming out with the racial appeal to whites. Listen to how he walks that line.
Let those who have the responsibility to enforce our laws and our judges who have the responsibility to interpret them be dedicated to the great principles of civil rights, but let them also recognize that the first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence, and that right must be guaranteed in this country.
Referring domestic violence, now we think of it as something that goes on
spousal
in your house.
Abuse, right,
yeah,
right.
And he was referring to riots in American
Brian,
cities.
I think that really what's run through all of this is race. And you mentioned dog whistles. I think they were a little louder than that under Wallace, who stood in the schoolhouse door to keep blacks from entering.
And but not on the campaign trail, Elizabeth, when he was on the campaign
Let me go on for a minute, please. I wasn't saying it was on the campaign trail.
Right.
I was saying that race ran through the campaigns, and Wallace stood for that. He was seen as that person.
That's true.
And Nixon picked up on race, the Southern strategy. It needs no further explanation. And Nixon, why did he pick Spiro Agnew? Because Spiro Agnew had, as mayor of Baltimore, had big battles with blacks and showdowns with them in appearances and so on. You go on through. Ronald Reagan began his campaign in Neshoba, Mississippi, near where the civil rights workers were murdered, and on it goes. So I think the Republican, there's been a strain in the Republican races all the way through on race. Now, you get to Trump, and what were the first words out of his mouth after he came down the famous scene of the escalator, which none of us will ever forget, were, nice. Mexico, they send us rapists, they send us murderers. Immigration equals race in many of these instances. Mm-hmm. And so the Republicans have been playing with that the entire time.
Let's go to some of
really
our...
Elizabeth's right, and it really did start with Nixon, because it wasn't true under Eisenhower, who got a significant portion of the African-American vote. But, you know, keep in mind, 1968, we had the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, the Voting Rights Bill of 1965, when Lyndon Johnson signed it, saying it was turning over the South to the Republican Party, and then the Housing Bill of 1968. My father was the majority whip of Congress in that time, and his vote for the housing bill almost defeated him. And he had been in Congress for 40 or for 20 some years. And the fact is that fair housing bill was a very dangerous thing for Democrats. It was the right thing to do, but it was very dangerous.
Also,
for Democrats.
You had the issues over school busing. That was very big. It was big in the North, which is what Kevin Phillips understood, and what Nixon ran on too. That yes, the South, but there are also areas of blue collar workers in the North.
Sure. And Louise Day Hicks in Boston.
That's right.
Let's bring in some of our callers with some oral histories from people who voted for Nixon in 1968. As we continue in our series, The Eights: A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. Our guests for today's segment: journalist Elizabeth Drew and Cokie Roberts, and Jerry in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. I voted for Nixon because I felt he was the best, apart from his somewhat unattractive personality, was the best qualified candidate. Mm-hmm. And Brian, I resent your posing the question, who will admit to voting for him? It's an unnecessary and very cheap shot. Race has been an issue in our politics well after this. The Democrats play the race card, too, only in a different way. And I don't only vote Republican. I voted, since Nixon, I voted for three Democrats. So...
That's fine. Of course, I was making a joke because Nixon's reputation turned into what it turned into. But what was it in 68? Let's stay on 68, Jerry.
Okay.
What was the Nixon versus Humphrey choice for you, if that was your choice?
It was mostly the dissonance in the Democratic Party. I felt Humphrey, I would have voted for Humphrey had maybe Chicago not taken place in the violent way it had. But I just felt there was too much influence that Humphrey, as president, would have had to, he would have changed in ways that I wouldn't have been comfortable with. And I didn't serve in Vietnam. I feel fortunate that I wasn't called. I didn't demonstrate against it, but I was opposed to the war. And traveling in Europe for a good part of 68, where there was a lot of resentment against it, and I learned a lot about not supporting the war when I was traveling, more than when I was in this country.
Jerry, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for calling in with that memory. Charles in Melbourne, Florida. You're on WNYC. Hi, Charles.
Hi.
And you were a Nixon voter in 68, right?
Nixon voter in 1968. Some of the reasons for that were just spoken of by the previous caller. I was very disappointed with the Democratic Party or the Democrat Party, especially in light of the goings-on of Chicago. And the feeling I got was that Humphrey was too fragmented and the party itself was too fragmented to accomplish removing us from Vietnam, which was my primary and main objective for voting for Nixon, who I did believe would get us out. As it turned out, ironically, I shortly then began demonstrating against Nixon in Washington with the hundreds of thousands of others. So my Nixon story starts out okay, but ends up badly.
Charles, thank you so much for that. Now, on this belief that Nixon would be more likely than Humphrey to get us out of the war, somehow resolve Vietnam, which we've now heard from two callers. Somebody wrote the other day that there's a parallel with the Russia investigation with Nixon in 68. Elizabeth, didn't he open up some kind of secret back channel in the Vietnam War peace talks that came to be considered treasonous by his critics?
Well, there were two things, Brian. And by the way, I write now for the New Republic, just so the publisher don't have a fit. First of all, Nixon said he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War. It remained secret, and he didn't have a plan, but that's what he kept saying. And poor Humphrey was, you know, I think Humphrey's had a kind of weakness that was showed in his being trapped by Johnson. Anyway, so one, there was the secret plan, and then there was the very famous incident where it appeared that the Paris peace talks were really getting somewhere. And what is known is that Henry Kissinger, who had worked both sides of the street during the campaign, but he decided he'd end up with Nixon, was making calls, and Nixon was making calls. And there was the famous Madame Chenault, who was very close to the South Vietnamese people in charge of the South Vietnamese government. Her husband had been a big World War II ace flyer over Asia, and she herself was Asian. And so Madame Chenault purveyed the word at the request of Nixon and Kissinger, we believe, to say, look, if they hold on, they'd get South Vietnam a better deal than they were about to get in the Paris peace talks. Mm-hmm. And so they sabotaged the talks. Now, they didn't get a better plan. The war went on for about five more years, and it ended pretty much the same way it would have had they accepted the plan in
with
Paris.
Hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese killed in the interim.
Yes. Let's take another memory from Lori in Brooklyn, contributing to our oral history. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Yeah, I was not a voter. I was a child, but my parents nearly got divorced because of the election. It's not a joke. My parents had been Eisenhower Republicans. They were proud that Eisenhower ordered the troops in 53 to go into Little Rock to support school integration. But the war and the 68 uprisings really split my parents apart. And of the four children, almost all of us were in the demonstrations in 68 in Chicago. My father was pro-Nixon. He thought Humphrey was incompetent, and he was appalled by his own kids demonstrating. My mom was one of the founders of Another Mother for Peace and had two draft-age sons that she was damned if she was going to see go to Vietnam. And the tensions got so high that I still can't believe their marriage survived 68. It struggled onward afterwards, but it came very close, and the whole family was in deeply torn asunder, and a tremendous hatred of Richard Nixon among all the kids, but with my father defending Nixon right to the bitter end.
Can I just ask how your parents did in the 1980 election with Ronald Reagan?
Well, my mother passed away in 72, so that wasn't an option.
Lori, thank you so much for sharing that story. Wow. And we're almost out of time. Cokie, as sort of a footnote, if you happen to know, Roger Ailes, who went on to start Fox News, of course, was a Nixon person in 68, right. Also Alan Greenspan, and of course Roy Cohn. Do you happen to know Roger Ailes' 1968 political origin story?
No, I was not aware of his presence in 1968. I've learned since that he was very influential in kind of trying to deal with Nixon and the debates and those kinds of things that Nixon had done so poorly against John Kennedy, at least visually. That's really all I can tell you about that.
And anything on any of them, Ailes or Roy Cohn in 1968?
Well,
Elizabeth?
I don't know
Roy
about Cohn.
Roy Cohn, but I think he was of a different category. But Ailes also advised Nixon on how to have these sort of town hall kinds of things and how to look, you know, this was a strain, this was difficult, but Nixon sort of looked more homey and less polarizing.
Scary.
Figure.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the
all
word.
Right. And there we leave it. And now I'm going to accurately identify Elizabeth Drew as now with the New Republic. And in those days, in 68, she was with the Atlantic. Many of you might remember that she did the letter from Washington for the New Yorker for many years. And she's also author of the relevant book, Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's Downfall, that came out in 2014. And, of course, Cokie Roberts, NPR senior commentator and author of books, including Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation. Thank you so much for joining us on our series.
Great
the
to
Aces.
Be with both of you.
It was fun.
Really great.
And
thank
also,
you.
WNYC listeners, give. You're just cheating if you don't, if you listen to the radio for free. That's stealing. Give money.
Thanks, Cokie. More to come. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Song that's in the news again today relative to the Russia investigation, but yes, that was the Rolling Stones from 1968.